we present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello, and welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a typo from a TripAdvisor restaurant review, read by Caroline Nichols.
We went here for a family meal, really welcoming and friendly. The menu had lots of good stuff, and there was lots of choice for the kids. They even did a small streak for my son.
Our thanks to Sue Jones for sending that in. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Francis Ween and Zoe Lyons. And opposite them, on my left, Simon Evans and Jeremy Hardy. Francis, who's been unable to construct an excuse for their actions?
Carillion, is it? There's been a devastating report from two House of Commons select committees into Carillion's downfall. They basically, well, they blame lots of people, but they do blame the board. They say that even when disaster was staring them in the face and they were about to go bust, all the directors cared about was sorting out their bonuses. Never mind the $2 billion of unpaid bills to suppliers and contractors and $800 million pension fund liabilities and all the rest of it. That was all irrelevant. What mattered was their bonuses and selling their shares as fast as possible before it all went to ribbons. And the chairman, rather wonderfully, who comes in for a lot of criticism, is called Philip Green. And he's not even that Philip Green. It turns out there's sort of an army of little mini-me Philip Greens. Going around boardrooms wreaking havoc in his name. And this Philip Green, joyfully, was previously David Cameron's advisor on boardroom responsibility. He blames them and blames the regulators because they were supine and passive and basically having a siesta throughout the whole thing. And the big four accountancy firms, they're the other big villains of this thing because they've established a kind of monopoly, the four of them. And because they're also consultants as well as auditors, they basically get it from both ends. So in the case of Carillion, KPMG signed off their accounts, very questionably, and then, as I think it was Deloitte, were brought in as consultants on some strategy or other. And then I think Ernst & Young came in when things started going pear-shaped to talk about relaunch and salvage operations and things, and that didn't work. So when they finally went bust, the one of the four big accountancy firms that hadn't got its check was PricewaterhouseCoopers. But never mind, because they were then the only big one able to come in without conflict of interest, so they were then hired by the official administrator as consultants. So they then got their cheque as well. So I think between them, they got about 72 million quid out of there. And they, unlike the £2 billion worth of contractors with their unpaid bills, they, I believe, will get every penny. And I mean, they've completely trashed the public sector and all. I mean, they did so many things. These firms, a bit like Crapita, they had this weird collection of jobs, everything from, you know, building prisons to supplying school dinners, which you think was slightly different skills, but anything that involves public sector money in enormous quantities going into their piggy bank, they will happily do, even if they're no good at it, and even if they don't actually know how to add up the sums, and even if they're bankrupting all their employees and the public sector.
I'm just a bit jealous that there are high-rolling accountants, because mine's quite lacklustre in comparison to to that lot. I mean, I just give him a carrier bag full of receipts and he keeps me out of prison, and that's all that happens. But no, it'll all happen with all the other, because they've all got, you know, stupid main. I mean, as Francis says, it's Carillion is actually a number that's a million times what any sane person would think they're worth. But mostly they have names like Snouts in Trophia and things like that. But no, I mean, so much of the public sector is just hurling money at these people. It's all Blair's fault. Blair thought it was a great... John Major sort of came up with it as a half idea and Blair just ran with it, because it involved posh people being rich, and that was kind of...
Yes, why couldn't Blair have run with one of John Major's other ideas, like the Cones Hotline?
Yeah, exactly. Have been so...
The report from Frank Field's committee and Rachel Reeves's committee, it's full of good stuff. I mean, I suspect Frank Field came up with this phrase. He said it was brought down by recklessness, hubris and greed. Mm. The scansion of that is so beautiful. It's
sort of, it sounds like a much more plausible title for a firm of accountants than the one they actually
have. Well, it is. it is actually a firm of city lawyers. I've come across them. I've been threatened by them occasionally in the past.
He described it as greed on stilts, which I thought, that sounds like a really weird capitalistic circus troupe, doesn't it? Sort of.
They were stuffing their mouths with gold. He gets a bit carried away occasionally, I think, Frank Fields. He was so thrilled because he did the last Philip Green, Sir Philip Green report. So every year, another Philip Green pops up and Frank Fields has to do another report on
it. I mean, Simon, I know that you see the good in everyone. Do you think the findings are fair?
Am I allowed to use the word on radio?
The jury's out on yet, because you haven't yet made it clear who it's directed at, Simon.
I think I would probably direct it more at the Big Four. They should be the target of the reform. If you release capitalist rats into the sort of environment in which they're able to commit these sort of atrocities, we've surely learnt by now they will do so. The idea that they would use any kind of what we would recognise as human morality in order to determine the correct course of action is nonsense. We need proper checks and balances. KPMG are public enemy number one in this. Even the name sounds like a metric used in a video game to determine how many kills per minute you've managed to achieve. They are evil personified. They break it up. They evade capture. They've had the job for 19 years. They signed it off with the clean bill of health about 2 months before the first of the major seams burst, spilling poison. And it's absolutely absurd. And it's worth mentioning, incidentally, these are the people of whom Michael Gove said we had had about enough under the guise of experts and how we chortled because they had contributed reports saying what damage Brexit would do. Well, this is exactly the reason that people have no faith in the major financial bodies that are supposed to be running the country.
I mean, you think what fat cats get away with, and then when I think when I submit my accounts every bus ticket is accounted
exactly.
for.
I'm this, not even allowed
this
to
was going to
man.
An audition, and that's £2.30. You know, it's the little man has to give an account of himself so accurately, yet these people are getting away with so much, so much.
One thing I liked was they had an arrangement which was managed for them by Santander, whereby they would refuse, they had a take-it-or-leave-it approach to suppliers who would have to wait 120 days to be paid. 120 days of Sodom, basically. And they could escape that outcome only by accepting worse terms. If they wanted to be paid any sooner than that, they could renegotiate a lower price, which presumably they'd already negotiated down to the bone anyway, during which, of course, Philip Green has bought another yacht.
Claude Coburn, the journalist of yesteryear, when he was quite broke and living in Ireland, was bombarded with final reminders of various bills of a Carillion sort, and he had this standard letter he'd send back to them saying, "Dear sir, you don't seem to understand the system on which I pay my bills. When you send me the first reminder, it goes into a basket, and once a year, I stir the basket with a stick, and I take out 4 bills and pay them. Any more letters from you, and you're out of the game."
I'm feeling a bit sorry for capitalism now. I mean, I've always been quite... It's been quite critical, but it seems everyone's really piling in at this point. Everyone's so hostile to the accountancy firms and the banks. I mean, I feel sorry for the big banks because they're now having to compete with the ones that give out free food. And they don't get enough credit for creating the conditions in which those food banks are able to thrive.
This is the Select Committee report into the collapse earlier this year of outsourcing firm Carillion. Carillion's directors have been accused of recklessness, hubris and greed, surprising those of us who thought they were simply big-hearted dreamers who were only guilty of looking for love in all the wrong places. If you think that those involved will truly be held to account, you're mistaken. These chaps will no doubt be listening to this episode on the BBC World Service while topping up their tans, seemingly unaware that the staff at the Barbados Hilton are pissing in their carver and rubbing their balls on the Eggs Benedict. Meanwhile, there's still no word on who caused the collapse of Maplin's. For those of us who are left with a £20 gift card and no means of exchanging it for a skirt lead, the fight for justice goes on. Still, you can say what you want about the bosses of Carillion, because they're bastards. Two points to Francis. Zoe, who's coasting into public hands?
This is the story of East Coast Mainland, which is going to be renationalised by the government. It's a franchise that's been held by Virgin and Stagecoach Group together. Chris Relling said they're going to take it back. They're going to rename it the London and North Eastern Railway, which is quite nostalgic because that was what the company was called when it ran between 1923 and 1947. So it's a blissful time, really, for Brexiteers who... can once again get aboard a steam train and wave their blue passports as they dash through the British countryside. So, yes, I mean, and the nuts and bolts of the thing is, it's anybody who uses the train in this country will tell you it's a really complicated system as well to get a cheaper ticket these days. There's, to get a ticket at a reasonable price, you have to jump through hoops and answer puzzles and meet a gnome under a bridge at a certain time to riddle me this, when can you get to Manchester for less than £35? I mean, I always think, do you ever wonder about tourists coming over to this country and sort of saying to themselves, do you know what would be really nice? Why don't we go to Manchester for the day on the train? That'd be lovely. From London to Manchester. Let's go and get ourselves a ticket right now. £800? What?
When there's any talk of renationalising the railways, people say, oh, the French have nationalised railways and everyone's on strike. You think, yeah, but that's France. So people go on strike because management bans absinthe breaks before 10 a.m. I mean, but the reason people were on strike a lot in the 70s in the public sector here was because of the top-down system, which we wouldn't be having under Corbyn, because he's more of an anarcho-syndicalist, when workers would be on the boards and everyone would have a go at driving the train, it'd be fun. But so you'd have worker participation. But in the old days, of course, the public sector was all run like independent capitalist countries with horrible management boards, and everybody was on strike, which in a way was great, because you couldn't get to school because the trains were cancelled, the buses were cancelled, there'd be power cuts in the middle of lessons, halfway through assembly it would turn into a polling station because there'd been election called, and you just you'd have to go home. It was great.
Grayling, the wretched minister who was finally forced into this nationalisation, was asked, well, now that Stagecoach and Virgin have saved themselves basically £2 billion in contractual fees that they were meant to pay, will you consider whether they should be allowed to bid for future franchises until they sort themselves out? And he said, no, there won't be any comeback, because they've suffered enough already. They've suffered enough reputational harm, and we don't want to make it any worse for them. Reputational harm, not nearly enough reputational harm. Richard Branson and Brian Suter, they're still taken seriously by some people and, you know, admitted to polite society. And
but also, with the East Coast Main Line, it's Virgin have 10% of it and Stagecoach have 90%, which is that's the firm Brian Suter owns, who spent a lot of his own money
trying to stop gay people having equal rights.
Trying to stop gay people having equal rights. And also, the other thing is, why has it been given to him anyway? I mean, that is a bus company, and a bus company should not be put in charge of running a train, should it? Because you wouldn't get on a space rocket that said GWR on the side, if it would, you...
All people want in this country is a rail system that works. That's all we want. We want one that works and that we don't have to sell our homes to get a ticket for. And toilet doors don't open up when you're using them. Because that has happened to me. You've got to press the locky button. I know that now. I know that. I closed the door but didn't press the locky button, because in your mind you go, well, that's locked, isn't it? And about 30 seconds later, when I was fully committed to the project, door just slid open beautifully, just really slowly, but beautifully.
It's sort of like the curtains in a chapel of rest, just sort of slowly.
I was on a train and I walked in on a lady having a wee, and then suddenly shut the door and ran away and went to the next loo, and I walked in on another lady. If I'd had my wits about me, I'd have said, you haven't seen a guide dog, have you?
This is left-wing revolutionary, the Right Honourable Chris Grayling MP, and his Marxist wheeze of taking the East Coast Main Line back into state ownership. Grayling says the measure is only temporary. Well, so, as it turned out, was the USSR, comrade. The East Coast franchise was a joint venture between Stagecoach and Virgin, with both companies playing to their strengths, those strengths being respectively disliking the concept of gay marriage and nothing. It turns out they had overestimated the value of the contract, now that most people have cottoned on to the fact that wherever you go in this godforsaken country, life is equally miserable. 2 points to Zoe. Simon, who's enjoyed some cross-party basmati?
Yes, this is a rice reference to a strange triumvirate of remoning, whatever you would want to call it, anti-Brexit rhetoric from an unlikely trio, Nicky Morgan, a Tory MP, David Miliband from Thunderbirds, and Nick Clegg, erstwhile of the Sheffield Hallam Parish, I think. But the three of them gathered together in a rice factory, which I have to say didn't feel to me like the most dynamic setting for a vision of where Britain could be going if it can only stay in Europe, but never mind. The drift of these three is that they feel that they don't want to see a hard Brexit. Of course, they want to see a soft Brexit.
It was a weird collaboration of faces in a strange environment, though, wasn't it? Mm. Watching it, all it made me think was, do I need to buy rice? Have we got got enough in. That's
I just wonder if they were told beforehand what the stage was going to look like. You know, they said, we're going to do it here, but I can't believe they were actually told that they would have sandbag piles of rice in front of them, behind them, beside them.
It was like a Samuel Beckett play or something, wasn't it? Sort of vaguely absurd, like they should have been buried up to their waists in rice. And...
Do you think all the questions, well, everyone was just so focused on rice, that it was such a heavy rice branding that when they gave their presentation, they said, does anyone have any questions at the end? People would say things like, yeah, why is it that when you think you're cooking enough for one, you always get enough for about seven?
Nicky Morgan is one of the few Tories where you go, aww. Most of them you go, oh, my God. But with Nicky Morgan, aww. Shame she's a Tory. She'd probably feed the cats. If you were on holiday and you said, I'm going away for 2 weeks, of course I'll pop in and feed the cats. You know, where the rest of them, the cat would be nailed to the stereo as a warning to other cats.
Yes, you
sorry, I
your...
got bored with your needy feline.
Yeah. I'm afraid we privatised your cat while you were out.
Yes.
I feel a little, I mean, I'll be honest with you, the main thing to say about Brexit is... I've had enough of it in news format. I think it's about time we switch to something a bit more appropriate to the speed at which it's happening. Maybe a tapestry or something would be...
These are the antics of Nicky Morgan, Nick Clegg and David Miliband, who this week shared a cross-party platform to campaign for us to stay in the single market and the customs union, prompting anguished Remainers who've been asking for months, is there anyone who can save us from Brexit, to ask instead, is there anyone else who can save us from Brexit? The meeting had to be held in the middle of a rice factory after Nicky Morgan dropped Nick Clegg in a puddle and somebody said it was the best way to dry him out in time to make some untenable promises in an earnest manner. David Miliband said Jeremy Corbyn could end up as the midwife of hard Brexit, as if any of us want to picture Jeremy Corbyn as a midwife, standing down the business end, holding onto someone's calves and muttering that this is why he became a vegan. A lot of people on the centre-left seem to have forgotten what David Miliband was actually like. Having anticipated some kind of dreamy cross between Richard the Lionheart and your favourite art teacher, they appear slightly disappointed to rediscover that he's still just a man who couldn't even beat Ed Miliband. Anyway, the newly formed group of Clegg, Miliband and Morgan will now be touring their chilled-out brand of woolly-minded liberal paranoia around art centres and cereal processing plants for the remainder of the festival season. Catching a cold dose of hard economic reality in the laid-back surroundings of the Lowestoft brand milling facility is my hot tip for the feel-good gig of the summer. 2 points to Simon. Jeremy, who's been dishing out dodgy careers advice?
Kim Jong-un's got very upset now, and everything was... There was this burgeoning bromance between him and Trump, and they were having this summit. It was all going to be great. And then this was all messed up by Trump's new security advisor, John Bolton, who has an extraordinarily ordinary name for someone in Trump's circle. Most right-wing politicians in America these days are called things like Chet Spanks and... Dario Thunderclarks. But he's just called John Bolton, and he suggested the approach to Korea should be the Libya model. Now, an optimist might think he means that the CIA and MI6 should kidnap Korean dissidents and send them back for him to torture, which is what we did for Gaddafi. But the Korean leadership took this as being a reference to the fall of Gaddafi, which wasn't really a winning formula. I mean, it's not going to win people round, that, is it, as an offering? But I mean, what part of dying with a bayonet up your jacksie is going to appeal to even a normal person, let alone a dictator with a fragile ego. So they're not. I mean, look, what you've got to do, if you want them to denuclearise, you've got to sort of suggest something that's face-saving, that makes it look like it was their idea, and then everyone can, you know... It's like if you were to think about your partner and you think, what surprise would they like for Valentine's Day? Would it be champagne and roses or being machine gunned by mobsters in a garage on the north side of Chicago? It would be champagne and roses, is my point.
America's policy about it is that they want generally North Korea to just stop what they're doing. It's only about just making sure America is safe. When he says, you know, I want this to be a victory for the world, not just for me, do you think that Trump feels that he can stop North Korea behaving in a sort of maniacal way? Or do you think it's simply just have them, but just don't point them at us?
Trump has no thoughts at all. He just has a series of bodily functions.
I I think he's phototropic, isn't he? He's phototropic. You've got to give him that.
He follows the sun gradually as it arcs across the sky.
Yeah.
Not necessarily
the man of the sunflower. He has that capacity.
Not necessarily the real sun. I'd suggest a bit of pan stick and one of those Breville things you like, Annie, at the gym. Things just come out, not always out of the right orifice even. He's just a narcissist. He has no opinions or views or hopes or dreams. He's just a sort of guttural, sort of needy person who craves instant gratification. Whereas John Bolton is a serious warmongering lunatic.
John Bolton is a magnificent figure. He's fantastic, Bolton. Have you seen
He looks like William H.
Huge.
Macy.
He's got this massive Custer-style tan. He looks like the sort of man who would ride into the Situation Room on a horse and take his orders and give them out, you know, with a big plumed hat on. I think it's exactly what is needed to deal with careers. General inflated sense of its own importance.
They should send him over there
on a horse, on the plane. He should remain mounted the whole way. Come down the escalator off
the plane.
Straight. Exactly. He has a tremendously no-nonsense approach, which is, you know, I think it's appropriate. But I totally agree with Jeremy, and I am delighted to see that we are in consensus that Tony Blair is to blame for 3 out of 4 of the top stories so far this week. Because the Libyan example is, of course, exactly what will create problems, whether or not they mention it to him. That's exactly the disastrous precedent they've set for how the West deals with cantankerous dictators who have nuclear ambitions.
It does seem a bit silly to jeopardise the meeting. It appeared that Trump had managed to do something that no other political leaders had managed to do up to this point and get, you know, Kim Jong-un into a meeting. Let's be honest, he's a particularly volatile character, you know. So why come out with this now that we're going to go for a Libyan model, you know, and sort of put the wind up him? It's a bit like going, yeah, we look forward to meeting you. And your silly hair. I mean, you know, say it afterwards.
This is the news that the summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un could be in jeopardy, which means the end of the world is back on. Good news for everyone who's already ordered their outfits for the big day. I'll probably end up going as a Valkyrie, as I always do when pushed for time. This is after National Security Advisor John Bolton suggested that Kim Jong-un could end up like Colonel Gaddafi. Telling someone they're going to end up like Colonel Gaddafi is no way to get on their good side. It is classic first date mistake. Kim Jong-un slammed John Bolton, saying, "We do not hide our feelings of repugnance towards him. I prefer the British way of smiling at them through gritted teeth all year long and then at Christmas re-gifting them a candle." Bolton's memoirs are called Surrender is Not an Option. And let me tell you, gift wrapping certainly is an option. No home should be without a copy. I keep mine wrapped up in a carrier bag in the cistern of the downstairs loo. 2 points to Jeremy. And at the end of round one, the scores are Francis and Zoe have 4, and so too to Simon and Jeremy. We start round two with an announcement heard on a flight from London to Geneva.
As we have someone on board with a severe allergy, would passengers please refrain from eating their own nuts for the duration of the flight?
Let's face it, we've all tried.
Thanks to Jess Millow for sending us that. Francis, is someone getting married this weekend?
Well, I haven't seen anything about it in the papers. Is it Harry and Meghan? Because Harry, I mean, he must be so surprised to find he's marrying someone who has even more embarrassing relations than he does. With Meghan Markle, you get about 20 for the price of one. I mean, the whole clan is just incredible. There's a Jim Bob Markle and Randy and Brandy and Rowdy and Uncle Buck. One of them making moonshine down Butcher Harlan or something, and then I think one of them runs an alligator petting zoo in Florida. And it's absolutely. One of them, actually, in Florida, is bishop in his own church that he invented. He runs a church, so he and the Queen would have a lot in common, but he hasn't been invited, so they can't chat. I mean, he's one of the more ordinary members of the Markle family. I mean, there's this woman called Tracy Dooley who flew in this week with her two boys, I think Tyler and Tom Jr. About half the family are called Tom Jr., just to try and confuse us. And they're the ones who run a cannabis farm, obviously. And her only connection is that I think 20 years ago she got divorced from Meghan Markle's half-brother that she doesn't even speak to. Well, on the strength of that, Tracy Dooley has flown with her boys, and she's not invited to the wedding, so maybe it's a business trip. There was a rumour she might be commentating for someone on the wedding.
She's doing the highlights for BT Sport.
Is it? I wonder if it might be that, yes. Well, ITV had to put out a statement denying she had anything to do with them because they already employ Piers Morgan, and that's enough shame and embarrassment for them. any television station to have on its books. And actually, Piers Morgan interviewed yet another of these people. I think the half-sister, who's called, you know, Tammy Faye Darlene or something. And she is the one who is not invited. And she said, I think my relations with my half-sister are not good at the moment because of what the tabloids have done. You think, well, it might be possibly because you've announced that you're writing a book called Diary of a Pushy Princess's Sister. Just a clue that perhaps they're not best of friends. And she also turns out to have been responsible for this awful business with the father, poor yet another Thomas, who got conned into doing some paparazzi photos or collaborating with a photographer. And that was her idea, because she said it would make him and the royal family seem more human for some mysterious reason. And meanwhile, his other son, Thomas Jr., as so many of them were called, wrote an open letter to Prince Harry saying, for God's sake, don't marry my sister. She's a shallow, conceited, vain woman, and she's gone back a fool to you. And he also said it was going to be the biggest disaster in royal wedding history. Anne Boleyn might have something to say about that. So the only person going from her family is her mother, so far. She's the only one who hasn't said a word. And maybe these two things may not be unrelated.
But, I mean, all weddings are quite stressful, aren't they? This kind of level of scrutiny. And also what she's going through. She's someone, she's got this sort of successful career, and then suddenly she's changing and coming, living here, and she's, you know, we've got to do, we'll suddenly have a title or whatever, and become a princess or whatever. Sometimes members of the construction industry call me princess, and I feel very flustered. So, how she feels about it, I've no idea.
I have a problem with the super fans. I just find them odd. Very, you know, the people who camp out about 4 or 5 days ahead in a little Union Jack sleeping bag on a little deck chair to get a good view with their collection of tea trays and thimbles from various weddings that they've gone before. And they sit there for 3-4 days sometimes before the parade comes along. You know, where did they go to the loo? Have they got commode deck chairs? Is that what they've got? That's what I'm thinking they've got.
They've just got a lot of thimbles.
Just a lot of thimbles. Finally, we have a use for these thimbles. Maureen, I'm going to need a bigger thimble, love.
They do it like those champagne pyramids. Yeah. I need someone to hold each hand.
I think it's a shame that the majority of her family aren't coming. It would sort of liven things up a bit, really. It would, because you were talking about Tyler Dooley, who's the cannabis farmer, and he said he wants to create a blend of cannabis in her honour called the Markle Sparkle.
Yes. You know.
Well, they're not allowed to come. They're going to be sitting at home watching on the television and see that Prince Andrew is allowed. I mean, how demeaning is that?
I think half the nation will be just tuning in to see what Beatrice has got on her head this time, won't we?
Maybe that's the big surprise. Maybe it'll be Thomas Markle. Simon, you look like you're absolutely just raring to go. You're very excited about the wedding.
I look back to the days when royal weddings were conducted in order to settle the situation in, you know, Schleswig-Holstein for the next 30 years. And they shook hands after it and went their separate ways. And I think that was a much more sort of sensible way of going about things, to be honest. A couple of mistresses and a dog and you were sorted, you know?
I haven't the energy anymore. I mean, I'm a Republican, but I'm not devout. I'm a sort of secular. But in some ways, I've come around. I don't really care that we have a monarchy. I think, well, if we don't, then that raises the prospect of a referendum on what we're going to replace it with. And we'll end up with a junta headed by Ed Sheeran.
This is the royal wedding between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, which is taking place this weekend. I shall be watching it just as long as it's on in the British Legion, where I wake up most Saturdays. I always dress up on royal wedding day. Union Jack, top hat, monocle, wedding dress, no undies. Keep it loosey-goosey. 2 points to Francis. Zoe, who won't own up like a grown-up?
This is a story from New Zealand, New Zealand Parliament, to be exact, where I think this week in Chambers, their Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, was speaking, and one of the members of the opposition was heard to call her a stupid little girl. And the Speaker of the New Zealand House overheard this, stopped proceedings, and asked him to own up and to say who'd said it. Stopped it, went, right, it's your own Tommy Wasting. Who said it? Come on, who said it? And they all went, I didn't say anything. And nobody's admitted to calling out and calling her a stupid little girl. I mean, it seems sad, actually, coming from New Zealand. It's quite, if you've ever been there, it's a very friendly country. The first time I flew to New Zealand, the Prime Minister of the time was actually in the airport handing out flyers. It's that sort of, John Key was there handing out, I don't know, for a garden sale or something, I'm not sure, cakes he'd made. It seems like quite a nice sort of progressive place, you know. And she's quite remarkable. She's the youngest female leader in the world currently, and also pregnant. And it's not the first time that she's had to sort of battle off misogynistic language. When she became Prime Minister, there was a very awkward interview on Australian television where the journalist just kept going on about when the baby was conceived. When was it conceived? Let's try and work out. Well, you want, were you popping it through the letterbox? And popping it through the letterbox? Is that what you were doing, really? People are just fascinated because she's a very able woman who's going about her business, you know. Not the only use of misogynistic language this week. We had the deputy head of the Bank of England, Ben Broadbent, who referred to the economy as in its menopausal phase. He backtracked and said what he actually meant was it was post-productive. You know, it's like the loss of Ben. He just was a bit premature with his language.
I think he meant it was overheating.
Overheating, is that what he's just lying with a window open going, God, is it hot in here?
Hey, we were in New Zealand together.
Yeah, we formed some gigs.
In fact, we briefly ran it for a while, didn't we?
I must say, people were tremendously nice.
That's right. Yes, they were stationary. All sorts of things.
I remember doing a gig in New Zealand, and I do get the accent is quite clipped. You know, it's a bit more clipped than an Australian accent. Before I went on stage, the lovely stage manager said to me, when you go on stage, Zoe, would you like a cheer? And I sort of modestly went, well, listen, if they applaud, I'll be happy. No need to sort of rally them up too much. She went, no, a cheer to sit on. I was like, oh, God.
I loved it there. Everyone is tremendously friendly there.
I was there for the comedy festival in Auckland. They had a local radio station that used to have traffic reports that tried desperately to find some sort of snarl up that they could report. And they go, oh, it's backing up a bit on Queen Street. Oh, no, the lights have changed. It's all right again. Well, we'll get one of these days.
But the fact that they don't know who it is also suggests that their politicians get on well with each other within the party. Somebody knows who said it, and everyone said, I've got no idea who said it. Any of our mainstream parties, if someone had done something and they wanted to know who it was, somebody else within their own party would already, you know, briefed about it within absolute minutes, and yet they actually seem to have sort of genuine solidarity about
No one likes the grass, Miles.
Gosh, you're threatening. These are the latest sensational happenings in New Zealand, where Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was called a stupid little girl in Parliament, but no-one knows who said it, and none of the potential culprits has owned up. Proceedings were immediately halted by Speaker of the House Trevor Mallard, although you might think if you're trying to restore an atmosphere of decorum and respect, it's probably best not to have the name Trevor Mallard. Until the culprit is identified, the New Zealand... 2 points to Zoe. Simon, have a listen to this. If you ain't doing nothing, let's fly away.
It's never off my stereo, I can assure you.
It was nice to see you mouthing along, Simon. Simon, which holiday brand might have had its day in the sun?
Well, Club 1830, I think this is, which is owned by, is it Thomas Cook? Is that correct?
That is correct, Simon.
Thomas Cook owned this brand, but they're considering selling it or reviving it or allowing it to wither and die or... I don't know what you do with brands, really, to be honest. It's just a word and two numbers, isn't it? I can't imagine it has a great deal of intrinsic value. But anyway, they're concerned that it may have had its day. Young people apparently are no longer interested in sun, sea and sex on their holidays now. They're much more about selfies, celebrities and celibacy. And that's a disappointing trend generally among young people. They don't drink as much as they used to, certainly not in binges. They are far more concerned about social media profiles and having holidays that look good on social media. And apparently the idea of drinking cheap cocktails in some bar, and I don't even know where Club 18... I mean, to be honest with you, I've realised I would be too old now to even go on Club 18 plus 30. So that's quite a depressing realisation. If they make it Club 50, 68 or something, they might recapture some of those people who were enthusiastic about that sort of thing at the first time. I don't know if it's a genuine thing or whether it's a bit like Heinz salad cream, which they pretend to be about to get rid of in order to inspire a lot of nostalgic enthusiasm for it and people will go out again. But perhaps this kind of holiday has had its day.
When I stayed in Monmouth because I had a gig at the Savoy Theatre, the rather grandly named Savoy Theatre in Monmouth, I was buying my ticket on the train and the man asked me how old I was and I was a bit offended because I thought he was asking me if I was entitled to a senior citizen's pass. And I said, I'm 56. He said, oh, well, then you can join Club 55, which is people over 55 get 2/3 off, but they miss off the last bit of it because they don't call it Club 55-2 because that would be death, wouldn't it?
I was a bit surprised. Can I be a member for your remaining years?
When it said people prefer selfies to sex, I wondered if it meant selfies in the old-fashioned sense of the word.
Though I think that young people would rather take pictures of their foods than get an unidentifiable STI from a phone party after drinking 10 shots of toilet duck flavoured booze. I mean, there's the good times gone, you know.
Perhaps it's the general trend towards antibiotics no longer working that's actually killed the holiday off, is it? There's a lot of resistance.
I think Simon may be onto something, that it could be one of those stories that is deliberately planted by Club 18 to 30 to get, well, tons of coverage, but also tons of nostalgia, not from present 18 to 30-year-olds, the sort of millennials, because they're obviously lost to everything, but so that they can then just rebrand it and get all the old Club 18 to 30s along, because they feel so nostalgic seeing these pictures of people getting disgustingly drunk and taking all their clothes off. Because there was a story this week about Frey Bentos pies, and suddenly everyone was getting nostalgic about Frey Bentos pies, the most disgusting objects in culinary history. And they planted this story saying, oh, millennials don't know how to open the tin on a Frey Bentos pie. And it was so obviously a tenuous story, just designed to have lots of pictures of people of a certain age say, oh, I so remember those pies. I used to have them with powdered mashed potato. Oh, bliss.
So is that what he'll be buying the holidays, then? You think that rather like sort of elderly criminals getting together for one last job or whatever?
Well, I think they'll team up with Saga Cruises will be merged with them. It'll be Swan Hellenic. In between the lectures on Greek civilization, you'll then just take all your clothes off and dive into a cocktail.
Do you go on a lot of sort of lads' holidays, Francis?
No, when I was 18 to 30, I was just counting the years until I qualified for a Saga cruise, I'm afraid to say.
Has anyone here ever been on a lads'?
I'm afraid not.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah? Have you been to any of the, like, Ayia Napa or Magaluf?
No. I flew back from Egypt 2 weeks ago, though, and we got delayed for 30 hours. And so they put us up in one of their celebrated hotels. The human buffet scenes were something I'll never unsee. It was frightening. It was horrific. I felt like Kate Adie should have been commentating on it. I actually finally lost it at the Pharaoh-themed barbecue evening. That's when I absolutely got stuck into the all-inclusive vodka and had to be carried out when the boss came to get us. So it's not really my thing.
Sounds like you were able to adapt pretty quickly. This is travel agent Thomas Cook, who have revealed they're open to selling off the famous Club 1830 brand due to declining interest from young holidaymakers. Without Club 1830 holidays, it's hard to say how young people will get the grounding in etiquette they need should they be required to perform oral sex at a phone party later in life. I remember these kinds of holidays. Shag all night, drink all day, then come 5 o'clock, it's into the next church on the list and time to sing Evensong. The problem, in my view, is that they're not cutting to the chase and renaming it something more sophisticated and appealing, like Sex Butlins.
Chlamydia Parks.
Two points to Simon. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting that they would like to share? Francis.
Yes, Charlotte Farmer saw this in the Hampshire Chronicle. A lorry driver accused of smuggling illegal immigrants into the UK has been released from jail, an innocent man. Richard Onslow explained the prosecution's difficulties. The case has been reviewed, and it appears there were some problems identifying the defendant's lorry. Some problem identifying whether the immigrants were in that particular lorry, and some problems in identifying the defendant as the person who was helping whoever it was and whichever lorry it was.
Zoe?
This was an advert on Amazon sent in by Nigel Blaisby in Ely, Cambridgeshire. It says, warm through men's heated vest. £20 recommended retail price. 14 days cooling off period following purchase.
Simon.
I have another one from Amazon. I should say other online retailers are available for the time being, but not for much longer, I suspect. Anyway, value thick roll mat was spotted by Richard Fox of Bridgnorth in Shropshire. And this was the review from a customer. It said, I ordered this for a Cub Scout camp for my 9-year-old son. The mat is lightweight and comes with two plastic elastic straps. For occasional use, this is absolutely fine at the price. My son commented that it was thicker than his friend's.
Jeremy.
Miles, Simon Leach saw this note on the door of St Patrick's Catholic Church in Soho Square in London. We have sadly had a high number of theft incidents from inside the church recently. And then it says, thieves. The church is covered by CCTV, 12:20 p.m.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score. Francis and Zoe have 8, but this week's winners are Simon and Jeremy with 9. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from a letter to Grange Now magazine sent in by Chris Rigby.
Dear editor, it was a joy to visit the town's open garden last month. I was impressed by the colour and range of plants being grown. One house I visited in Fernley Avenue was quite petite, but packed a tremendous display of flora. I also greatly admired the gentleman's neat back passage, giving a sense of space with subtle fragrance from many climates.
And with that, goodbye!
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Ween, Zoe Lyons, Simon Evans and Jeremy Hardy. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Caroline Nichols. The chair script was written by Madeline Brettingham, James Kettle and Robin Morgan, with additional material by Mike Shepherd. The producer was Sam Michel and it was a BBC Studios production.